Good morning and welcome to St. Stephen's Green Unitarian Church, whether you're here in person or joining us on the web or listening back afterwards. If this is your first time with us, you are particularly welcome. My name is Lane Sisson, I'm a member here, and this church has a tradition of an open pulpit, which means that members of the congregation are invited and encouraged to lead the service, and today is my turn. Last Saturday, we installed our new minister, Gavin Byrne, and Bridget reminded us that Gavin is only the sixth minister, including herself, to serve this church since it was built in the 1860s. And one of the reasons that number is so small is because one of those six, the Reverend Ernest Saville Hicks, and the subject of my address today, was minister here for 52 years. There's a plaque on the wall here marking this achievement, which is either a tribute or a warning, depending on how you look at it. So, our opening words. We arrive out of many singular rooms, walking over the branching streets. We come to be assured that brothers and sisters surround us to restore their images on our eyes. We enlarge our voices in common speaking and singing. We try again that solitude found in the midst of those who with us seek their hidden reckonings. Our eyes reclaim the remembered faces, their voices stir the surrounding air. The warmth of their hands assures us, and the gladness of our spoken names. This is the reason of cities, of homes, of assemblies in the houses of worship. It is good to be with one another. And now I'm going to light our chalice. Something that happens in Unitarian churches whenever Unitarians gather together. We gather this hour as people of faith, with joys and sorrow, gifts and needs. We light this beacon of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning, in celebration of the life we share together. Our first hymn is hymn number 92, Mysterious Presence, Source of All. Just to note that a fuse that blew in the church has meant that our Beatitudes are not alight, but that doesn't mean to say that we don't still hold them in our heart. But instead, I would like you to join me in saying the Lord's Prayer, please. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we lead against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. The power and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Our first reader this morning is Aidan.
Good morning to you all. I'd like to read a piece about courage this morning. It's written by Laura Marlowe, who is an Irish Times correspondent, journalist, and it's entitled The Miracle of Courage. Laura Marlowe should know something about courage herself. She was married to Bob Fisk, the distinguished Middle East war correspondent, and I think it's an interesting piece. I hope you enjoy it. Courage for me is one of the greatest virtues, up there at the top with love and charity. Courage is a miracle because it is contrary to the survival instinct which tells us to keep safe and seek protection. Courage requires us to take risks. It can endanger your peace of mind, relationships, career, and in extreme cases, your life. In more than 40 years of journalism, I have often witnessed courage and its mirror opposite, cowardice, in politics, business, and daily life. It is most obvious in war, which brings out the best and worst in people. The Second World War still feels very present in Paris, where I live. Through 4 years of Nazi occupation, most French people just tried to get on with their lives. When the liberation was imminent, thousands became des résistants de la dernière heure, last-minute members of the resistance. Only a tiny percentage had the actual courage to resist occupation in the darkest hours. I asked myself, what would I have done? I want to believe that I would have had the courage to engage, to join the resistance. We cannot know until we are tested. The question was hypothetical for most of our lives. It is less hypothetical now. We are entering an era where courage is required of private citizens, most obviously in the US, but also across Europe. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine has reminded us of the power of courage as a force in world politics. When the US and UK tried to spirit President Volodymyr Zelensky out of his country on the morning of February the 24th, 2022, he replied, "I need ammunition, not a ride." It was widely predicted that Russia would seize Kiev within days. This did not happen, and the courage of Ukrainians has preserved their country as a sovereign nation. Lorimar continues. In August 2023, I was in Kiev reporting a story for the Irish Times about women in the Ukrainian armed forces. The women's soldiers group, Vitoranka, put me in touch with half a dozen women in the military. Among them was Lieutenant Yulia Mikitenko, then 28 years old and the commander of a drone reconnaissance platoon on the front line. She had joined the army in 2016 on graduating from university. Remember that the war had started in 2014 with Russia's seizure of the Crimea and much of the Donbass. Lieutenant Mikitenko's husband, Ilyich Serban, also a soldier, was killed in a Russian artillery bombardment on the Eastern Front in 2018. Soon after I interviewed Yulia, I returned to Paris, but thoughts of that courageous young woman stayed with me. I wrote to ask if I could write a book about her life. Life on the front line is exhausting, and Yulia wasn't really interested. But she eventually accepted because, as she told me later, the Russians are very good at propaganda, and it's important that the Ukrainians tell their side of the story. I remain awestruck by Yulia's courage, which to me is emblematic of the courage of a people. Never before have I come to know so much about an interviewee. Yulia jokes that I remember her life better than she does. Writing has been a hard slog, as she is a private person and never boasts about her exploits. She minimized the importance of the medal she received from President Zelensky in December 2022 for, I quote the citation, "individual courage and heroism while rescuing people, endangering one's own life." While Yulia and I were working on the book, the French writer François Sureau delivered a speech on the theme of courage to the Académie Française. This passage from the conclusion of his speech reminded me of Yulia. At the beginning of these adventures, there is solitude, darkness, the impossibility of seeing the consequences for oneself and for others. Courage is a leap into the unknown, taken by the light of a dark lantern. There are no more prophets, no dogmas, no signs to show the way, only the example of those who have preceded us on an endless path, in a peregrination that expresses the best of what we are. Courage has a cost. Yulia has lost more than 20 close colleagues and says that she no longer feels emotion. As Yeats wrote, too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Her mother, Tamara, a psychotherapist, posted a text on social media last autumn, and it helped me understand why Yulia sometimes seemed distant. When Yulia came home on leave in 2017, her mother, Tamara, writes, something felt strange, as if at last my dearest person was beside me, and yet somehow seemed like someone else. I rushed to hug her, but she tensed up. In the cafe, she sat with her back to the wall, eyes fixed on the door. Crowds irritated her. She barely let go of her phone, always in touch with her comrades. Her mother, Tamara, has developed what she calls a safety protocol for Yulia's visits. Before I hug her, I ask, can I give you a hug? I don't approach from behind or touch unexpectedly. I avoid sudden movements. Before inviting guests, I ask if she has the energy for people. I cry only when I see the tail of the train taking her back to the war. Consider the difficulty that Yulia has in readjusting to civilian life and the care that Tamara takes to help her. Multiply that hundreds of thousands of times and you see as the idea of the scale of the cost of courage. The mental and emotional turmoil caused by war continues long after. Laura Marlowe concludes her article, courage means the willingness to speak up and act, to take risks, including financial and economic. We must find the courage to stand up for those less fortunate than ourselves, for our own rights, and for what is right, full stop. Our survival as individuals and as a society depends on it. So, Yulia Mikitenko, from a small church in Dublin, Ireland, that commemorates its own courageous fallen with plaques on the wall, can we wish you Godspeed and good fortune. Slava, Ukraine.
Thank you, Aidan. I have a little story for you, for children and children at heart. It's called The Tiger and the Artist. It's an old story from China, no idea of its provenance, to be perfectly honest. A young man, soon to be married, wished to give his bride a truly special gift. He'd heard of a master artist in a nearby village, a man whose brushwork was said to carry the very breath of life. And so he made the journey to his studio to commission a drawing of a tiger. In China, the tiger is no ordinary creature. It's a symbol of power, of courage, of protection. And a tiger drawn by a master artist would be a gift worthy of a lifetime. The artist listened carefully and said, yes, come back in 6 months and it will be ready. 6 months, the young man raised an eyebrow but said nothing, so he thought he's busy, he went on his way. He married his bride, the seasons turned, and 6 months later he returned to the artist's studio to collect his gift. The artist greeted him warmly and asked him to sit, and then, reaching for a blank sheet of paper, dipping his pen into the ink, the artist drew a tiger in minutes. With swift, confident, breathtaking strokes, a magnificent creature appeared on the page. It was, without question, extraordinary. But the young man was a little bit disgruntled. He'd waited 6 months, and he'd missed the chance to present the gift on his wedding day for something that had taken the artist only minutes. He felt a bit annoyed. Master, he said, choosing his words carefully, I'm deeply grateful. The drawing is beautiful. But why did you make me wait 6 months for something you've just drawn in minutes? The artist said nothing. Instead, he rose quietly from his seat and walked to a tall wooden cabinet against the back of the studio. He turned the handle and opened the doors. And the room changed. hundreds and hundreds of sketches and drawings came cascading out, spilling across the floor in every direction. Tigers, tigers in every form, every angle, every mood. Tigers mid-leap and at rest. Tigers drawn in delicate detail and in bold, sweeping lines. Studies of paws, of eyes, of the curve of a shoulder, the coil of a tail. Sketch after sketch after sketch. The artist looked at him gently. "This," he said, "is why you waited 6 months." And now we have our second hymn, which is hymn number 102, "We the Heirs of Many Ages." For my second reading, I've asked Ayla to read for me.
This is from a sermon by Saville Hicks called The Secret Room. It has no date, but much wisdom. Can you worship without going to church? Of course you can. But will you? Do you, when you hide yourself from the light of your clergyman's countenance on the Sabbath day, do you stay away in order to worship? The fact is that a church has two major uses. It stands a quiet grey sentinel over the passing generations. Down its aisles have tripped many a happy bride, and down its aisles the bodies of those we have loved have been borne to their last resting place. It also has a hidden self, or as we sometimes say, an atmosphere. Its walls have vibrated to hymns of praise and gladness, roll of organ music, and exhortations to piety and virtue. Every mood and tense have been and still are registered here. And as you come to worship, you are entering on a heritage of piety and prayer which is venerable. It is a really wonderful heritage, if you come to think of it. A legacy from the past on which no price can be set. A legacy of freedom of thought, of progressive thought, of aspiration, praise, and prayer. Bound by no set creed, you are bound by a deep and true conviction and obligation to make your lives as useful and helpful as possible to your fellow pilgrims on the road of life. It is indeed a great tradition, a free gift from the splendid past, but a wonderful legacy from the past, carrying with it a deep obligation and responsibility to the present and to the future. All this was not given to us in order that we might just live on it as parasites, or squander it as wastrels, or selfishly let it deteriorate into neglect and decay. It is our privilege and obligation to carry on that great tradition of free and reverently progressive thought, useful life, and devout worship to the greater glory of God and the truer discipleship of Christ.
Thank you, Ayla, powerfully read. I'd like to lead us now into a period of meditation and prayer by reading from St. Paul's book to the Galatians, which the type is so small, I hadn't really thought this out. This is my childhood Bible, so I thought it would be meaningful, but actually it's really not very useful. But the letter is from Paul to the Galatians, chapter 6, verses 2-4, followed by a period of silent meditation where I'd like you to sort of think about maybe some of the words that Aidan spoke about courage, or Ayla has taught about this atmosphere here, and we will be led out of meditation by Doreen and Josh giving us some music. Bear ye one another's burden, and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if a man think himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself. But let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. For every man shall bear his own burden.
Thank you.
Thank you, Josh and Doreen. 52 years. Now, some might say that's about 20 years longer than any sensible person would stay in a job. And I would have agreed with that until I started to count up my almost 30 years of membership here. And at that point, it didn't seem such a long time. But think for a moment about what 52 years actually means. Ernest Saville Hicks took up his post here in 1910. He was standing in this pulpit during a series of seismic events for this city. The Dublin lockout, when the city was raw with hunger and anger, when the guns of the First World War opened up across Europe. At Easter 1916, when the city was suddenly on fire. He was here when three young men from this congregation went to that war and did not come home. He was here during the War of Independence, navigating curfews and military checkpoints. He was here in 1921 when the state was founded and when it almost immediately tore itself apart in civil war. I believe he was involved in negotiating that febrile, barely peace of 1923. He was here through the labour struggles of the 1920s, the arguments about what this new country could be and should be, the fights for decent housing, for workers' rights, for universal suffrage. He was here in the 1930s as the Depression ground down into the poverty already worn through the city. He was here as the Eucharistic Congress swept through Dublin and the Catholic hierarchy quietly, firmly, began to extend its reach into the corners of public and private life. He was here as the Spanish Civil War split opinion at dinner tables across Ireland. He was here as the shadow of Hitler grew longer across Europe and still here through the long, terrible years of the Second World War. Regardless of our neutrality, the war came into this city and into our families. He was still here in the 1950s and early 1960s as people began quietly and against considerable resistance to push for more progressive, more humane ways to live. 52 years. He died in May 1962 without ever retiring. He welcomed people into this church, he married them, and he buried them. He officiated at the wedding of Moisey and Charlie McCaw. And there are people here today who remember him warmly, which is perhaps the most any of us can hope for. When I volunteered to give this address, I thought of it as a straightforward historical chronological piece. I agreed with Gavin that in any consideration of Saville Hicks, I would do the history, he could do the theology, each of us reverting to our own kind of expertise. But history is not a straightforward narrative, instead a type of detangling, combing out the knotted strands, and I am sort of a philosophical hairdresser. And so remembering E. Saville Hicks has been more difficult than I thought. Any time over the past few months when I've talked to people about him, I've heard new and fascinating stories. And this is the first of what could easily be a multi-part series, not committing myself to doing any further addresses. But consequently, I'm choosing here to focus on his early years, from the 1910s to the 1930s, mostly because this is my own area of historical expertise, but also because there's just too much to cover otherwise. So let's start with the facts. A profile in the Irish Times in 1960, marking his Golden Jubilee and his election as moderator of the NSPCI, outlines his background. He was born in Lancashire in 1877 and attended Jesus College, Oxford. His family had lived in both Scotland and Northern Ireland, where they became Unitarians. Saville Hicks decided to take orders and trained as a Unitarian minister in Manchester College, graduating in 1901. His first appointment was in Lancashire, and from 1903 to 1910, he was minister at Islington in London, during which time he married Mabel Ormrod. He was appointed minister of this church, and at his installation on March the 31st, 1910, almost exactly 116 years after Gavin's installation, it was noted that the church was decorated with beautiful spring flowers, as ours was also last week. The order of service for the 1910 installation lists a reading from St. Paul's letters to Timothy, which I attempted to identify in the hope of including it today. Having now read Paul's advice to Timothy, all I can say is, poor Timothy. What a pinched and joyless view of the world. And I really hope that the reading was not Paul's instruction that women should learn in silence, refrain from teaching, refrain from arguing, and on no account speak, because that is more or less my entire career. So Savile Hicks' time here began. His output, energy, and varied social, cultural, and political interests are challenging to map as they branch out in many directions. He gave two different addresses every Sunday, one at 12 noon and one at 7 in the evening, and he also spoke often at events during the week. Some of his addresses were printed and circulated as pamphlets through the Irish Unitarian Christian Society, established in 1830. The subjects chosen for public distribution reveal what our church thought important. The first pamphlet, printed in 1911, is called The Right to Think. Other pamphlets set afloat into Irish life during the Free State years were called The Loneliness of Life, Is Religion Losing Its Hold, The Spirit of the Age, The Difficulty of Unbelief, Live and Let Live, and The Soul of the Nation. What richness of ideas at such a time. His papers are now in the Royal Irish Academy, so for the most part my information is drawn from newspapers in which the titles of his weekly addresses and occasional lectures are advertised. And this is how I know that during his first year, he gave four addresses called Four Faiths and Their Founders on Buddha, Muhammad, Confucius, and Zoroaster. During these years, he spoke often on religious freedom, with addresses titled A Rational Faith, The God of Silence, the aforementioned The Right to Think, The Evolution of Conscience, The Unitarian Faith, Atheism, and Agnosticism. Talks on literature included Oliver Goldsmith, Thomas Carlyle, Dante, Tennyson, Umar Khayyam, Dickens, Shelley, Marcus Aurelius, Robert Burns, Arthur Conan Doyle, Arnold Bennett, and a series on the relationship between religion and the stage. He spoke on censorship and Egyptian culture and what it means to be human. He was a man interested in the boundaries of science, of death, of life, and the afterlife, about which he talked often, both here in this church and in public lectures. He was a member of the Society for Psychical Research and spoke many times on spiritualism, reincarnation, and psychic energy, including some great titles, Wireless Messages, The Lesson of the X-Ray, The Reality of Things Unknown, and The Traces of Forgotten Things. He was present at a seance in 1915 with the well-known psychic Hester Travers Smith, George Yates, wife of W.B., and Lennox Robinson, the playwright and a director at the Abbey Theatre. His role was to record the proceedings, something for which he was apparently well known, when, allegedly, the words of Sir Hugh Lane came through. Lane was returning from America on a ship called the SS Lusitania, and Mrs. Travers Smith only found out the following day that the ship had been torpedoed and Hugh Lane had drowned. Bethel Solomons, the eminent physician, recalls in his memoirs how he had worked with Savile Hicks to devise treatments for what sounds like early applications of hypnosis and psychotherapeutic techniques. Savile Hicks was a man interested in social justice and equality. He spoke often against poverty and poor housing. Through him, we get an insight into the work of this church and the people associated with it. He officiated at the funeral of Margaret Huxley, commemorated by the Huxley Window. She was a pioneer of nursing. She founded the first nursing home in Ireland and oversaw the building of 10 houses in Cork Street in a crescent which still bears her name. The congregation supported the financing of the crescent by running a two-day jumble sale, which I sort of think that must have been some quality jumble in Reefer's Inn. A less well-known member was Avram or Adrian Golden, who had been a political prisoner in Russia. Jewish by birth, he considered himself a communist and a Unitarian, and is buried in Mount Jerome. Savile Hicks conducted the service there in 1911, which was attended also by James Larkin and Francis Sheehy Skeffington. Hicks visited member Marguerite Palmer in Mountjoy Prison after she was arrested for breaking windows in Dublin Castle at a suffragette protest. He was an advocate for women's rights, speaking out on the sweated conditions of numbers of women workers, it's a quotation, at the Irish Women's Reform League. It's not surprising for me to find him there, as the League connected the campaign for women's political rights with broader questions of poverty, workers' conditions, and social justice. In 1916, he spoke on casualties in peace and war, and during the following years, he spoke out against sectarianism. Outside his clerical and pastoral duties, he also found time to write a novel called The Moth and the Flame, 1931. I haven't yet found a copy, but it's described as a novel, quote, that deals with the drug problem and introduces the subject of psychoanalysis. Moreover, it has a strong love interest and an old-fashioned happy ending. Should add that to the book club reading. He was interested in film. He was the chairman of the Dublin Cinema Renter Society and mediated in the cinema union labour strikes in 1924. At this point, it may help to mention that the Hicks household employed, at the very least, a butler. And I offer this not as a social observation, but as a public service, so that none of us feel entirely inadequate by comparison. Radio offered him a new way to speak to broader audiences about one of his great loves, music. He became known as a broadcaster, introducing the works of Wagner, Tchaikovsky, Beethoven, and the operas of Puccini and Verdi, amongst others, on the national radio station when it was set up in 1926. During the 1930s, he broadcast live from this church, prefacing a performance with a talk on the music. He was described as being, quote, highly dramatic in his delivery with never a dull moment for his listeners. So two examples of concerts from the 1930s. In 1934, the paper of record declared that one of the most interesting events should lie in the relay from the Unitarian Church, St. Stephen's Green, Dublin, where the Reverend Savile Hicks will give an illustrated lecture talk on Wagner personalities. Mr. Hicks is well known for his powers of description as a lecturer of wide knowledge and one who can make even the dullest subject highly interesting. In 1936, a radio listing reads, 9 o'clock, lecture, Tchaikovsky, The Man and His Music, arranged by Reverend Savile Hicks with Edith Mortier, soprano, and Arthur Thornton at the organ, relayed from the Dublin Unitarian Church, St. Stephen's Green. So the tradition of public live concerts from this church is probably a little older than we think. As if it wasn't busy enough, he also founded and edited the social magazine Irish Tatler and Sketch. With his wife Mabel, he was a well-known and award-winning dog breeder, especially fox terriers and Dachshunds, and he acted as chairman of the Irish Kennel Club. Flann O'Brien, Miles Nagopoline, bought an Irish terrier from the Hickses, and then he fretted in his newspaper column, Cruiskeen Lawn, about whether his dog was a Unitarian dog, a Protestant dog, a Catholic dog, or a Jewish dog. A few years after his death, his successor, Kenneth Wright, inaugurated the Savile Hicks Memorial Lecture. It ran every 3 years between 1967 and 1988 as a series of free public lectures from invited speakers. The talks ranged from the place of religion and education, rural regeneration, well-being, human nature, and art and architecture. After 1988, the tradition seemed to die out. And perhaps this is something we may think about reincarnating in time for the 150th anniversary of Savile Hicks's birth in 2027. What does moral leadership look like for us? The great crises of our time are genuinely complex. The ecological emergency, the upheavals of technology, the fracturing of public life. Moral leadership begins somewhere quieter. Faithful attention, intellectual curiosity, loyalty, showing up week after week, year after year, decade after decade. What holds us here? Is it the architecture, the stained glass turning ordinary light into divine transcendence, the pillars that keep the church upright? Is it legacy? Is it the weight of those who were here before us? I was raised in a very different kind of faith, one that's plainly spoken, plainly decorated, doctrines certain of themselves. Yet in that certainty, I felt the pull towards other things. Where is there room for poetry when faith speaks only in prose? Savile Hicks was someone who moved easily between the spiritual and the secular, who extended his care into domains where religious engagement was unusual and sometimes unwelcome. He was curious about the full range of human experience. He was not afraid of the strange or the unresolved. 52 years is not simply a career. It is a life given in service. So finally, I did, after all, find a redeeming verse from St. Paul's letters to Timothy, which I hope was the verse read at Savile Hicks installation and is offered here as an epitaph and tribute. It's from the second epistle, chapter 4, verse 7. I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. Amen. Amen. And now we shall sing our third hymn, a hymn that was sung at Savile Hicks installation. It's hymn number 87, Nearer, My God, to Thee. And this will be followed by the offertory. Now, our notices and my thanks. I'd like to thank my Dennis in absentia, Ayla for reading today, Aidan for reading today, Rory and Bridget who helped me thinking about this, and to Josh and Doreen for the lovely music, and for Madeline for leading the communion service before this service. Our notices, Easter Sunday next Sunday, normal service resumes. Gavin, our new Minister Gavin, will be back in the pulpit. There's the AGM on the 29th of April, and there's a plant sale on the 10th of May. 26th of April is the AGM. Sorry, thank you, Bridget.
One more notice, which is in keeping with the long tradition of social justice activity in this church. On Friday, Good Friday, this coming Friday, we will have a gathering for justice here in the church at 5 o'clock, from 5 to 6, and it's on the theme of immigrant justice, and all donations received will go to the American Civil Liberties Union in the United States, who represents immigrants who are at risk in terms of their civil rights at the moment. So you're all very welcome. We have, can I just mention, a fabulous couple of musicians coming, especially for the service, and you'd be very welcome. Thank you.
I would like us to sing our final hymn, which is that great hymn of John Bunyan, Who Would True Valor See, which seems to me right in the keeping of the spirit of Reverend E. Savile Hicks. Hymn number 106, Who Would True Valor See? Our final words are from Theodore Parker. Be ours a religion like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space. Its creed, all truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living. Amen.